Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also at alexlinder.com, eventually. Today we're going to do a chapter from Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. How the idea of sexual liberation is sold to people in order to manipulate them, social engineer them, control them, turn their vices into your political profit. This book's by E. Michael Jones, published back in 2000. E. Michael Jones is a prominent Catholic intellectual, the best one I know of. Book was published, St. Augustine's Press, out of South Bend, where Notre Dame is, in 2000. We're going to do Part 3, Chapter 18, Philadelphia, 1976, today. So let's dig in. This is an average sort of length, maybe 15 pages. Take about an hour. In October 1976, as part of that city celebration of the bicentennial of the Declaration of Independence, a law professor by the name of Leo Pfeffer, silent P, let's say, a German Jew type name, we've heard him before. Leo Pfeffer arrived in Philadelphia, October 76, to give a paper to the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion called, quote, Issues That Divide, the Triumph of Secular Humanism. The sexual revolution was now over in America. That's how quick it all was. All these changes from about 64 to about 75, one decade. And it was over because it succeeded beyond the wildest dreams of its most perfervid supporters. Good word there, one of my favorite adjectives. And adjectives aren't any great thing, but perfervid, extremely fervid. During the 15 years prior to Pfeffer's talk, America... Also, that means pepper in German, Pfeffer. America had quite simply revised its culture to eliminate laws which conflicted with sexual libertinism. If America were a computer, one could say that the default settings had been changed. Good analogy or metaphor. At the beginning of the seventh decade of the 20th century, the culture of the country was based on a pan-Protestant reading of Christianity whose assumptions favored, in an imperfect form, albeit, remember he's a Catholic, so, a rough approximation of the moral law. Of course, the Catholic would have a refined, since the deposit of faith belongs to the church, right? So they've gone from, you know, the moral code that bound Hollywood being reversed in the 60s, gun laws reversed, immigration policy reversed, flip on prophylactics, condoms and such, from being illegal everywhere to being a constitutional right to being promoted by the government in the U.S. and around the world for population control. We heard about last chapter, part 317. Anyway, so he's saying that our default settings were switched from, not too terrible, pan-Protestant reading of Christianity, he calls it, a rough approximation of the moral law. By the end of the decade, the default settings had been changed in favor of a culture that was individualistic. If it feels good, do it. Whatever floats your boat. You do you. These are all ways of saying the same thing. Don't worry about anyone else, man. You get your rocks off. You know, rationalistic and hedonistic, especially in matters sexual. And remember, Huxley said they'll take your political freedom and give you sexual license in exchange, turn people into consumers of experiences in others' bodies, and let them worry only and worship only about money, right? It was not just that people's behavior had changed. Those changes had been inscribed in both the culture and the Constitution, or at least how it was interpreted, in the rules that govern people's lives. And Leo Pfeffer was one of the main agents of that change. He's a Jew, of course. At the time of his talk in Philadelphia in 1976, Leo Pfeffer was a professor of constitutional law and chairman of the Department of Political Science at Long Island University in Brooklyn, New York. The credentials hardly seem distinguished. In a profession where prestige exists in inverse proportion to the amount of time an academic spends in the classroom, Professor Pfeffer had what seemed to be a distinctly unglamorous joint appointment in an undistinguished state school. A look at the awards he had garnered in the years before the talk, however, gives a better indication of his accomplishments and the changes he himself was instrumental in bringing about. Born in Hungary on Christmas Day in 1910, Pfeffer arrived in the U.S. at the age of 2, was a naturalized citizen in 1917, and married in 1937. At the time of his speech in Philadelphia in 1976, Pfeffer had received awards from Americans, formerly Protestants and other Americans, United for the Separation of Church and State, the Minnesota Jewish Community Council, the New York Unitarian Universalist Church, the Brooklyn Civil Liberties Union, the Horace Mann League, the Unitarian Universalist Association, the American Jewish Congress, and the Committee for Public Education and Religious Liberty. At the time of his talk, he was special counsel to the American Jewish Congress, as well as counsel for the Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights, and a member of the Advisory Committee on the National Project for Film and the Humanities. In the years following his talk, he would receive an award from the American Jewish Congress in 1980 and the Humanist of the Year Award in 1988. Pfeffer's bio reads like a roadmap of the revolutionary changes that had swept through American society over the previous 20 years, as society got Jewed, effectively, is what I often wish, you know. Well, he's an academic. People have to act the way they are, according to their station in life, I guess, and it wouldn't be condign for him. Condign's a fancy adjective that means appropriate or meet. Wouldn't be condign for him to be going off like me or someone like that, but I'd say America got Jewed. It went from, roughly sane, white, Protestant Christian moral law to Jude, let it all hang out, etc., etc., do what you want, whatever you want. If Pfeffer had come to talk about the triumph of secular humanism, he was well qualified. He had been intimately involved in virtually all of the battles that had brought about that triumph, so he's kind of like Emanuel Seller, working for decades from 1924 to the triumph of 1965 to overturn the immigration law. So in all of these sort of tines of the fork that's overturning the soil of American society, you know, you're going to find some Jew who's working to turn the law on its head, reverse it. Beginning with the Schempp decision in the early 60s, S-C-H-E-M-P-P, and ending with the Lemon decision in 1970, Pfeffer was the architect of the legal strategy which removed the last vestiges of Protestant culture from the public schools and denied government funding to Catholic schools. So if you want to be a religious, moral, right-wing type, you have to double pay. You have to fund the people you don't like. And this is directly what led to the rise of homeschooling starting right around this time, the end of the 60s. If his listeners wanted a description of how the triumph came about, it was clear that Pfeffer could give a first-hand account. With the candor of a victor who had nothing more to fear from his opponents, Pfeffer was never vague about who it was he was fighting all these years. For Pfeffer, the enemy was, quite simply, the Catholic Church. In a memoir which appeared a year before his talk in Philadelphia, published with mordant irony in the liberal Catholic magazine Commonweal, Pfeffer went to some length to explain his animus against the Catholic Church. "I did not like it," Pfeffer wrote, "because it was monolithic and authoritarian and big and frighteningly powerful. I was repelled by the idea that any human being could claim infallibility in any area, much less in the universe of faith and morals, and repelled even more by the arrogance of condemning to eternal damnation those who did not believe it." The church which Pfeffer grew up hating, if that is not too strong a word, was the church he got to know as a Jewish immigrant in New York City. During the time Pfeffer was growing up and getting started in the legal profession, the Catholic Church was, in his opinion, one, if not the single, most powerful political force in the nation. It was a time when, to use his own words, Pius XI and Pius XII reigned over the Catholic world and Cardinal Spellman ruled in the United States. It was the pre-John 23rd Vatican II era, and it was during this period that my feelings toward the Catholic Church were formed. In the Commonweal memoir, Pfeffer refers to his daughter's threat when she didn't get her way to, quote, marry a Catholic army officer from Alabama, because that particular configuration of Catholicism, the military, and the South embodied all that Pfeffer, i.e. Jews, did not like about America. At another point, Pfeffer talked about the impression Catholic schools made on him as a young man. I often saw children lined up in separate classes as they marched in. All the children were white. Each group was monosexual. All the boys wore dark blue trousers and white shirts. All the girls, dark blue jumpers and white blouses. All the teachers were white and wore the same nun's habits. Once Pfeffer gets started, the reasons for his animus against the Catholic Church start to pour forth in an increasingly frank as well as increasingly hostile litany of offenses against the liberal Weltanschauung. Pfeffer did not like the fact that the Church opposed the Equal Rights Amendment. He is annoyed that, quote, among the children outside the parochial schools on the way to my office, there are only a sprinkling of black faces. He does not like the fact that the Vatican still defends papal infallibility and humanae vitae, the 1968 encyclical banning the use of contraceptives. He even opposes the practice of having first confession before first communion. Quote, I know it's none of my business, he adds, as if realizing that his animus is getting out of control, even by his own standards. But you asked, didn't you? The Jew is always willing to tell you how you should run your business, as well as insisting that he speaks for the community alone, and any contrary voice is, you know it, hate. Pfeffer disliked the Church because of its size and because of its unity and because of its internal coherence and because of its universality, all of which contributed to its political power. He disliked it as well because it was, in his words, monolithic, because with monolithity, he tells us, goes authoritarianism. Pfeffer had nothing against religion per se. He was only opposed to monolithic authoritarian religions, i.e. religions with enough clout to have a say in how the culture got organized. But even that is misstating the case somewhat. As James Hitchcock noted, neither Pfeffer nor the liberal media objected in 1973 when the Supreme Court established as the law of the land a policy on abortion virtually identical with the position of the United Methodist Church. Nor did the fact that the author of the opinion was himself a Methodist cause them much concern. The reason is simple enough. The media and their backers, by and large, agreed wholeheartedly with the decision. When it comes to the separation of church and state, some religions are more equal than others. And some are clearly more threatening than others as well. And in Pfeffer's view, Catholicism stood alone in this regard. If the Catholic Church had been willing to declare contraception and abortion the eighth and ninth sacraments, respectively, it seems doubtful that people like Leo Pfeffer would have been upset by her authoritarianism. The fact remains, however, that she wasn't, and therein lies the real reason for the animus of the liberals. During the entire post-World War II period in the U.S., the Catholic Church opposed the main article of faith of secular humanism, namely sexual liberation. Beginning with the creation of the Legion of Decency in 1933, and culminating in the opposition to Roe v. Wade 40 years later, the Catholic Church had consistently picked up the banner of sexual morality, which the mainstream Protestant denominations had let fall. The one great thaw in the liberal animus toward the Church came in the early 60s during the Second Vatican Council, when it looked as if the Church might reach a modus vivendi with modernity by legitimating the use of contraceptives. That dream was laid to rest in 1968, when Pope Paul VI slammed the door shut on the conditio sine qua non, the absolutely essential condition of cooperation with the liberal regime. When the news of humanae vitae, if I'm pronouncing that right, but it means human life, hit the streets, the liberals broke off relations and turned instead to a combination of open hostility and fomenting rebellion within the ranks. The lull in the fighting in the sexual revolutionaries' ongoing Kulturkampf with the Church ended abruptly in 1968. Thereafter, the hostilities were out in the open again. Pfeffer's animus toward the Church never really changed, but it did abate somewhat, primarily because the Church's influence in society had diminished, and because the confusion in its own ranks increased, in no small measure because of Pfeffer's activities. What do I think about the Church today? Pfeffer asked rhetorically in the mid-70s. In short, I still do not like it, but I do not like it less than I did not like it during that period. And the reason is that, while it is still what it was before, it is considerably less so, if you can make out what I mean. It's Jewier. It's gotten more Jewed. We can, without too much difficulty, make out what Pfeffer means. The only good church was a confused church. The more it approached the divided, tentative, and contradictory condition of Jewish and Protestant denominations, the more Pfeffer liked it. If the church was less powerful in 1976 than it had been under Pope Pius XII and Cardinal Spellman, Leo Pfeffer was in no small way responsible for that diminution of power and influence. Unlike the Kulturkampf waged by Bismarck in Germany, and that's where the word came from originally, it was first used, the Bismarck and North Germans against the Catholic Church. But it could mean any cultural struggle between, you know, institutions or ways of looking at things. Unlike the Kulturkampf waged by Bismarck in Germany during the 1870s, the one waged by people like Pfeffer and the Rockefellers in America during the 1960s proffered the carrot of government funding, publishing contracts, foundation money, and pro bono legal services more readily than the stick of government regulation. As a result, the cultural revolutionaries in America in the 60s found a fifth column within the church willing to aid and abet their plans. By subsidizing an obviously schismatic group like the Old Catholics, Bismarck guaranteed Catholic solidarity. There was no Prussian Charles Curran, Catholic liberal, no Prussian Theodore Hesburgh. The story of the Cultural Revolution in America in the 1960s is the story of the Catholic Church at war on two fronts. There was the enemy outside the gates, people like Pfeffer and the Rockefellers, and there were the collaborators within, who were often taking the money of the cultural revolutionaries to undermine the Church's position. Pfeffer, it should be remembered, published the memoir of his campaign against the Church in a Catholic magazine, Commonweal again. I used to read that in college. Leftist Catholics are some very, very weird people. I felt more uncomfortable around them than almost any other subset of alleged humans. But, hey, maybe I'm the weird guy. No. Let's see. So, yeah, okay. He also included in the same article a group of Catholics he found congenial to his cause. Quote, I voted for John Kennedy in 1960, Pfeffer tells the Commonweal readership, and then goes on to give a list of the liberal Catholics he could also conceive of voting for in the future. They would include Robert Drinan, Justice William Brennan, Eugene McCarthy, Senator Philip and/or Jane Hart, Dorothy Day, Theodore Hesburgh, and almost any member of the editorial board of Commonweal, although, he adds with a wry touch, I would not necessarily want my daughter to marry them. Kind of funny. Before we are very far into Pfeffer's account of how he won the Cultural Revolution, it became apparent that the major area of contestation was sexuality. Pfeffer fought on the side of the Protestants to decriminalize the contraceptive, and he fought on the side of his fellow Jews to free Hollywood from the Catholic-inspired production code. Remember the Catholics back in the 30s. It was the Hayes production code is what they ended up getting the Jews to agree to. They boycotted in a couple of big Catholic cities, I think the Philadelphia, where E. Michael Jones is from. We heard about this in earlier chapters. And I remember that the quote was that one of the Jews running one of the 6-7 studios, all owned and run by Jews that put out all the movies, cried a tear like as big as a mule turd or something that the Catholics successfully boycotted his movie. So that's when they agreed to the code, which is basically like, look, you can't have the bad guys win. You can't show, like, people screwing on screen. And, oh, it's a far, far more restrictive than that. But, you know, meant to provide essentially G-rated movies, even if it dealt with adult stuff. But then the point is that code prevailed from the 30s to the mid-60s. So he's saying Pfeffer was on the side of the Protestants with regard to birth control, condoms and such, and he was with the side of his fellow Jews to get the movie theater out of the production code because the movies can glorify sexual liberation. sexual promiscuity. They can glorify it. And if they do that, it will have a, like the, who was it that said, Yates or somebody, you know, culture is down, or politics is downstream from culture. So you get these ideas out there, they're going to eventually have a political effect. And a lot of pro-whites believe that too. I don't know, I think it can go both ways. When you have instant access to everything, as we do now with the internet, then anything could be influential depending on how much power it has, how many people back it and repeat its ideas and memes. As one sign of Cardinal Spellman's inordinate influence over American culture, Pfeffer mentions the fact that the Roberto Rossellini film, The Miracle, was declared blasphemous in the state of New York in the early 50s. In 1952, the New York State blasphemy law was struck down by the Supreme Court in the case of Joseph Burstyn, Inc. v. Wilson. So New York State 52 struck down blasphemy law. The other area of cultural revolution delineated by Pfeffer had to do with whose idea of the family would dominate in the culture. The major issue in the 60s was contraception, but that was soon replaced by abortion in the 70s. Think about how queer rights and queer marriage gave way to transgender stuff in the 2010s. As soon as they win one victory, they move on to their next campaign. They don't stop. Now, I would pause here to say, I think his discussion would really benefit from his taking on racialist, white nationalist ideas about the Jews attacking whites as a race, and that being their motivation, rather than simply going after the Catholic Church, which, after all, some of these same Protestants said always was breaking down racial distinctions wherever it went. So that would definitely add a different perspective to his argument, but he never deals with anything like that. So they get what they want on contraception, then it turns to abortion in the 70s. Of course, Roe v. Wade in 73. In the early 60s, to give some indication of the magnitude of the change which took place, it was illegal in many places in the United States to sell contraceptives, so it would be left up to the states, right? By the end of the decade, the government was not only not prohibiting the sale of contraceptives, it was distributing them itself. The two instances are not only indications of the situation before and after the revolution, they are causally related as well. The law had to go because the revolutionaries wanted government to get into the contraceptive business. According to Pfeffer, a block quote here, the anti-contraception laws had to be removed from the books because their presence made it impossible for the state to encourage contraception, something it now increasingly deems necessary to do. The middle income and the affluent, married and unmarried, use contraceptives. The poor have babies. When the poor, often racial minorities, are on the welfare rolls, taxpaying Americans rebel and expect the state to do something about it. Why did it take a more activist approach to anti-contraception laws? The answer may lie in the fact that the justices recognized the need to get the laws off the books to enable the states, plural, to take affirmative action toward encouraging and assisting birth control, or at the very least, not to prevent private groups from doing so. But they also realized that as a matter of political reality, the states were not going to repeal the laws, as the twice unsuccessful effort in Connecticut evidence. So even in the liberal northeastern state, they couldn't get the law they want. So when they can't get what they want from one sector, legislature or courts or executive, they run to another. So that if the majority is against them, they run to the judges, just as we've seen under Trump. In addition to describing the areas of contestation in America's Kulturkampf, Pfeffer also describes his understanding of just who the contending parties are. Again, the dividing line is essentially sexual. On the one hand, there were the Catholics who hope for an America in which, this is a block quote, if not all will be Catholics, all will adhere to Catholic values. No divorce, no contraception, no abortion, no obscene books or pictures, no homosexuality, everybody worshiping God in his own way, government solicitous of and helpful to religion, and children and adults equally obedient to their parents and lawful authority. Arrayed on the other side of the front lines of the culture war are liberal Protestants, liberal Jews, and deists, i.e. secular humanists, who, block quote, seek a different America, one in which individuals enjoy maximum freedom of thought and expression. Contraception is used and encouraged to control population and avoid the birth of babies that are unwanted or cannot adequately be cared for. Women's rights to control their own bodies is recognized and respected. The sexual practices of adults, whether of the same or different sexes, are of no concern to anyone but themselves. Government institutions avoid manifestations of religiosity. Public schools are free of sectarianism, and citizens are not forced to fight in a war they deem immoral or in any war. During the same month that Leo Pfeffer gave his Triumph of Secular Humanism speech announcing the Enlightenment's victory over the Catholic Church, as if to prove to the world that they had been beaten, announced a celebration of the American Bicentennial that went by the name of Call to Action. If Charles Curran's protest against Humani Vitae was the 60s equivalent of the fall of the Bastille, then Call to Action became the Catholic equivalent of the tennis court oaths. The actions culminating in the Call to Action conference began 2 years before the conference took place in Detroit, from October 20th to 24, 1976. The bishops were interested in participating in a celebration of the nation's bicentennial, but the nation was not in much of a mood for celebration. Watergate, the impeachment of President Nixon, and the ongoing, never-ending war in Vietnam occupied the nation's mind for the 2 years leading up to the bicentennial. While this sort of fear filled the evening news and occupied the nation, perhaps by way of indirection, the Cultural Revolution, which had begun in the mid-60s, was busy consolidating its gains in less visible ways. By the early 60s, Eddie Bernays's program for, quote, invisible government, unquote, through control of the instruments of culture, again, the father of public relations and the relative of Freud, Jew, Eddie Bernays, advertising, had become part of the common intellectual patrimony of a number of Jewish organizations who put the information to use in a campaign to remove prayer from public schools. Later, the same tools were used by Hollywood in its war on the production code and the Legion of Decency in their battle over who was to control the film industry. The crucial issue at the dawn of the 60s was nudity on screen. Hollywood was feeling financially threatened by TV on the one hand, which was stealing its family audience, and the new skin magazines like Playboy, which got founded in the wake of the Kinsey reports and the perfection of glossy color photography, and were testing the borders of pornography in the wake of the Roth decision of the Supreme Court. In many ways, it was the Weimar Republic's battle over cultural Bolshevism, all over again, except that this time there was no effective conservative resistance. The Catholics tried in their way to play this role, but were hindered by Jewish dominance in the media of communication and division in their own ranks following the Second Vatican Council. Leo Pfeffer knew that the Catholics were outgunned and tried to explain that fact as tactfully as possible. Quote, American Jewry, he wrote, partly too because many Jews, far more proportionately than the other faiths, are commercially and professionally involved in the cinema and publishing, has been overwhelmingly antipathetic to the crusade for morality and censorship in the arts and literature, end quote, which by mid-century had been taken over by Irish Catholics. Because the mainline Protestant denominations had abdicated their role as moral arbiters in matters sexual by the 60s, and the evangelicals were not yet a significant political force, that'd be like the later 70s, early 80s, Jerry Falwell and such, the battle over the Hollywood production code came down to an essentially Jewish-Catholic struggle, a fact noted by Pfeffer in his speech on the triumph of secular humanism. Quote, after World War I, Irish-oriented American Catholicism began taking over the leadership in anti-obscenity militancy. Catholic organizations such as the National Office for Decent Literature and the National Legion of Decency became the nation's most militant and effective defender of morals and censorship. After a number of unsuccessful attempts with vehicles like Billy Wilder's Kiss Me Stupid, released in 1964, Hollywood finally succeeded in breaking the code in 1965 with the release of the Eli Landau film, The Pawnbroker. During the course of the film, a woman playing a black prostitute opened her blouse and exposed her breasts to the camera, breaking, as a result, Section 7, Subsection 2 of the Motion Picture Production Code, and one of Hollywood's last remaining taboos, showing female breasts 65. Eli Landau's The Pawnbroker. I've told the story of the breaking of the code elsewhere, primarily from the perspective of the Legion of Decency, which saw The Pawnbroker not as the harbinger of serious cinematic art, but rather something that in the Legion's Monsignor Thomas Little's words would, quote, open the floodgates to a host of unscrupulous operators to make a quick buck. The next 7 years of cinema were to prove Monsignor Little and the Legion right, as a trickle of bare breast eventually became a flood of on-screen nudity, culminating in 1973 with the release of Deep Throat and The Devil and Miss Jones, two porno epics which made it into the list of the industry's top 10 grossing films for that year. And again, you know, you had no VCR back then, so anything that you wanted to see would have to be more or less communal at some kind of public house, even if it was a seedy raincoat type red light district joint showing porno films. You couldn't rent tapes and watch them at home, let alone get on the internet at that point. The summer of 65 saw, as a result, two great victories for the forces of liberation, quote-unquote, which were immediately transmuted into instruments of social control. The film industry was now able to use nudity to draw people into its theaters, and the government could now use the contraceptive as a solution to social problems. The first led to the exponential growth of the pornography industry, which redefined the universe of sexual expectations in a way that would prove devastating to women. The second eventuated in the destruction of the concept of the family wage and the emigration of women from the home into the workforce, where over a 30-year period, the male as provider would be replaced by both husband and wife earning what the husband alone earned before. Behind both examples of liberation loomed the specter of control, a fact which was true in a broader sense as well, because the result of both liberalizations was a sexually destabilized society, where more and more people succumbed half unwittingly to the financial exploitation of their passions and became, as a result, sexual and financial helots, the Greek word for slave. Slaves of the Spartans were the helots, I believe. Reason, as the classical tradition pointed out, provides the only point of stability in any social order. The more people that the Enlightenment could persuade to exchange a life based on reason for a life based on passion, the more people the invisible rulers could control through the illuminous science of advertising and its adjuncts. Of course, part of the fallout from any sexual liberation is social chaos, based primarily on family disruption. And so once again, in the wake of the 60s cultural revolution, horror began to make its appearance as a significant popular genre. And he's saying that horror, He wrote a book called Horror, a Biography, is code for our horror at sexual liberation. Now, here's actually where you could benefit from not even just a racialist, but a libertarian point of view about getting the women into the workforce, then the children they don't have. You bring in immigrants who lower the wage rates, you have a larger population, and it makes for a larger government. They have an incentive in supersizing the state. So whereas before, he's saying one man could earn what later a woman and a man could earn, and women became much more unhappy, much more addicted to pills because they wanted to be mothers, but they couldn't do it. You have really what he says is accurately is the destabilizing of society. The Jews like a big consolidated government. It makes it easier to control society from one point. They have one point leverage as a small minority over a giant mass. They take in its tax money so that most of the richest counties in the U.S., like literally like six of the top 10, are right around Washington, D.C., which is loaded with Jews. And private people find it harder to get rich. They find it harder to have a family life. They're exhausted. They're working, and half their money is taken. Instead of just one man working and having a small portion of his salary taken, you have two people working and large portions of both their salaries taken by the federal government, which after all knows what's best for everybody. So this is why small government is associated with whiteness inherently, because white men, if they can run their own lives, and who's going to say that they can't, They don't need a giant, supersized central government to take in all their money and distribute it to them. Now, where were we? So, they're going to seduce the people into sexual liberation, which is not that hard of a sell because people like sex. And they're going to do that using their public relations and their Hollywood and their other media control. And they use that also to influence the courts to make these decisions that spread what they want to do, make it legal to do, and then almost make it mandatory. Quickly becomes thereafter. You don't just have to tolerate these sex deviant queers. You have to bake cakes for them. You have to serve them. You can't laugh at them. That's a hate crime. You must serve them. This is so for reasons we have already mentioned, horror becoming a popular genre again, but also because the control of the human person that population control allows is far more intimate and therefore far more complete than any previous form of political domination. Michael Skouyans makes the point that even, quote, Marx's proletariat still had their children as their only riches. On the other hand, the contemporary problem forces the individual into the most precarious situation, since it deprives him of all control over his own concrete future, over a real future for his offspring, a kind of alienation, that's a Marxist term, heretofore unknown, even beyond the ideas of Marx. The result of birth control is not only more radical than that slavery of classical antiquity, but the means to that end are different as well. Instead of forcing people to act for the ends of those in power, the invisible rulers now induce the ruled to do so by getting them to act according to the rulers' unspoken sexual guidelines, because in controlling the agency responsible for the transmission of life, the controllers control human life at its source and therefore most crucial point. This kind of domination, according to Skouyans, S-C-H-O-O-Y-A-N-S, block quote, is at once more cunning, more pernicious, and more fatal in its effects. It is not at all new, but it has grown in an unprecedented way because of two decisive factors. On the one hand, it has benefited from the use of the most sophisticated techniques of propaganda and indoctrination. On the other hand, its effectiveness is assured by the media's guarantee of publicity. For contemporary totalitarianism, the question is no longer one of exercising physical coercion. Henceforth, it is a matter of destroying the ego in what is most profoundly personal in me. This is why contemporary totalitarianism has intellectual life as its target. It pummels the masses, but the intellectuals it re-educates by filtering, directing, and dealing in information. It inculcates a portable ideology, for ideology can encroach upon intelligence and disarm its critical ability, imprisoning it in a, quote, gulag of the spirit. Bit by bit, intellectuals are ensnared by manipulators of knowledge who are in the pay of the party, the race, the army, the powerful. Science is fostered to the degree that it delivers new technologies that can be integrated into a global strategy for domination. Again, Skouyans, I guess it's pronounced. As always, the instrument of control is passion. Quote, man, under the guise of being liberated and excited by the possibility of maximizing individual pleasure, disregards the stakes and consequences of sexuality. By taking control of pleasure at its source in sexuality, the neo-illuminists simultaneously take control of human life, which has the same source. And as an added bonus, the controllers also dominate the human conscience by manipulating its guilt as a way of defending the actions that enslaved the person in the first place. Liberal politics becomes then first the incitation to sexual vice, then the colonization of the procreative powers that are indissolubly associated with sexuality, and finally the political mobilization of the guilt which flows from the misuse of procreative power in an all-encompassing system that gives new meaning to the term totalitarian. Skouyans is one of the few people who sees the full ramifications of this biocratic revolution. Biocratic. Quote, we are at the dawn of a total war beyond the limits of anything we have known, and the horizon is already aflame with it. The present war is truly total in the sense that, by means of the power over life, it aims at control over human beings in what is most inalienable, their existence, their personal capacity for making judgments and decisions, and their responsibility before their conscience. The present war simultaneously involves each of these aspects as the stakes, the means, and the goal. This is what Kulturkampf meant in America in the 60s, and this was why Leo Pfeffer came to Philadelphia in 1976 on the 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence to claim victory in the culture wars and proclaim the triumph of secular humanism. Divide and conquer was the strategy which the Enlightenment, under the direction of people like Leo Pfeffer, used against the Catholics, and the social order of the Republic was the first casualty of his campaign. Once it began on October 20th, the Catholic bishops, attending the Call to Action conference in Cobo Hall in Detroit, soon became aware that they were no longer in control of their own celebration. The Call to Action conference in 1976 was in many ways the sign of that the Catholic Fifth Column, the traitors, which the Rockefellers had subsidized at Notre Dame, had come out in the open and wanted to run the church according to its own lights. U.S. Catholics have spoken, wrote Mark Winiarski in the National Catholic Reporter, the newspaper that represented the interests of the Fifth Column clerics most faithfully. The idea of a democratic consultation was used to disguise the special pleading of the clerical dissenters who wanted, in effect, the best of both worlds, the resources of the Catholic Church and sexual liberation. So the reporter's slant on the first Call to Action conference was that Catholics had spoken. The people of God had spoken, and mirabile dictu, miraculous to say, they wanted the same things as the sexual enlightenment wanted, namely, ordination of women, married priests, remarried divorced Catholics, spared excommunication, determination of conscience on birth control, a national arbitration board to control the bishops, and civil rights for gays, the entire liberal agenda within the church. In other words, the agenda of Call to Action was indistinguishable from that of Leo Pfeffer and the Rockefellers, and the purpose of their efforts was to weaken the revolutionaries' main enemy, the Catholic Church. In addition thereto, those assembled in the name of the church in Detroit in 1976 demanded that, quote, the NCCB and Catholic publishers should expunge all sexist language and imagery from official church publications after January 1978. Beyond that, they demanded that, quote, the NCCB and every diocese should undertake affirmative action programs. Under personhood, the conference affirmed, among other things, that communion should be given in the hand in keeping with the dignity of the human person, that the church should endorse the ERA as well as its political opposite pole, namely a constitution amendment to protect fetal life. And, last but not least, under the heading humankind, quote unquote, they demanded that, quote, third world people should be invited to this country to raise the consciousness of our people. Of course, most Catholics are third worlders, though. The people of the third world were undoubtedly honored by the invitation, but before long, as the proposals became longer and more politically charged, many observers began to wonder just how representative this body was of American Catholics at large, and if it was not, just whose interests, then, were these delegates representing? As even the unfailingly sympathetic Thomas Stahel wrote for America, S-T-A-H-E-L, America is another Catholic publication, who were the people who passed all these proposals? Many bishops were equally curious. As if to provide an answer, John Cardinal Kroll, K-R-O-L, Archbishop of Philadelphia, was overheard saying that the meeting had been taken over by, quote, rebels. Bishop Kenneth Povish of Lansing, Michigan, compared the gathering to the 1972 Democratic Convention, which nominated Senator George McGovern. I remember my father, Bishop Povish said, P-O-V-I-S-H, a Democratic voter all his life, asking afterwards who was representing me at the expletive-deleted convention. Probably fucking convention. Even the normally sympathetic Archbishop Joseph Bernardine disavowed the results of the conference, quote, the result was haste and a determination to formulate recommendations on complex matters without adequate reflection, discussion, and consideration of different points of view. Beyond that, quote, special interest groups advocating particular causes seem to play a disproportionate role. Then, in typical fashion, Bernardine disavowed his disavowal 2 days later, issuing a statement to the NC News Service saying he did not repudiate the conference. The strategy behind the sexual mobilization of the Catholic clergy could be deduced in equal measure from Wilhelm Reich and Martin Luther, who we've heard lots about earlier in the book. The example of 16th century Germany and the Lutheran revolt was apropos. Luther spent much of his time writing to various priests and clerics, urging them to marry and thereby break the solemn vows they had made. His motives in urging marriage on apostate nuns and priests were clear. Once that spiritual transaction had been accomplished, the apostate priest was firmly in the Lutheran camp, a fact that Luther exploited for its maximum political effect. Libido culminating in broken vows was the engine that pulled the Reformation train. It was a uniquely effective way of organizing ex-clergy in opposition to the church. Once they had made two contradictory sets of solemn vows, there was no way out. The marriage vows were, of course, invalid. However, in the natural order of things, especially after children arrived, they seemed every bit as compelling. Within me, one unhappy priest who succumbed to the trap wrote to a brother who was still a monk, a constant conflict rages. I often resolve to mend my course, but when I get home and my wife and children come out to meet me, my love for them asserts itself more mightily than my love for God, and to overcome myself becomes impossible for me. So they made a vow of celibacy to the church, and then they made a vow of faithfulness to their wife. So they're at odds. They can't resolve that because there's no way to resolve it. You got to go one way or the other. The genius of this revolutionary plan lay in its use of sexual passion as a means of social control. By breaking their vow of chastity, religious became committed to sexual liberation, to the social program of the Cultural Revolution, and as a result, to changing the Catholic Church from within. The sexualized religious became a permanent revolutionary cadre determined to make the church conform to its laws to their behavior, to make the church conform its laws to their behavior, and since the cultural revolutionaries controlled the religious by manipulating their passions, this meant that the church would have to conform its teaching to their program for total social control. In May of 1974, right around the time the American bishops and their assistants were making the initial plans for the 1976 bicentennial celebration that would be known as Call to Action, Father John Krejci, K-R-E-J-C-I, Krejci or Krejci, a priest on leave of absence from his diocese in Nebraska, completed his doctorate in sociology at the University of Notre Dame, having written his dissertation on, quote, leadership and change in two Mexican villages. Beginning in the mid-60s, the University of Notre Dame, where Krejci received his doctorate, was a crucial part of two very different worlds. Dissent was as yet an unknown phenomenon and would not come out in the open until the summer of 68, when Charles Curran organized the protest against Humanae Vitae. 1 year earlier, in the wake of Curran's successful tenure battle at Catholic University, Father Hesburgh engineered his Lando Lake statement, whereby he and a number of other presidents of Catholic universities effectively alienated a large amount of church property, namely those colleges and universities, from church control. But no one seemed to know that was the effective meaning of Land of Lakes at that time, like the butter. As a result, religious orders continued to send their nuns, priests, and brothers to an institution that was no longer a church institution and had in fact shifted its allegiance to the major foundations of this country in a bid to get first their money and then federal funding, the sequel to foundation money, as the government got more and more into the education business. It's true, the government spending on K-12 before LBJ was very small, and it metastasized during that period. And of course, colleges themselves grew hugely from 1945 to 1970, and the feds started getting more and more involved, as you know. During the summers of the late 1960s, literally thousands of nuns, as well as other religious, he always just says religious like that, it's kind of a little bit odd. He never says believers, he just says religious, would converge on the campus of the University of Notre Dame, ostensibly to continue their education, but also to imbibe the zeitgeist in an especially undiluted form. Notre Dame was heavily into sexual liberation for a number of reasons. To begin with, there was the effect the pill was having on the culture at large, and then there was the effect the pill was having on Notre Dame in particular. Donald Barrett was a professor of sociology at Notre Dame at the time. He was also on the Papal Birth Control Commission as well. So much was publicly known at the time. Not so public was the fact that he had been a participant at the Rockefeller conferences and, as a result, had applied to the Population Council for a grant to study contraceptive use. He eventually received around $500,000 from the Ford Foundation while still deliberating on the Papal Birth Control Commission over the licentiousness of contraception, the lawfulness. In any other venue, this would have been known as conflict of interest. In the Catholic Church in America, it was known as independent thinking and newfound maturity, like Tom Bethel's strange new respect for conservative politicians who, when elected, go to Washington and become liberal. William D'Antonio, head of the sociology department during the late 60s, was becoming well known as a result of his name appearing on Planned Parenthood ads condemning the Pope. One of the thousands of nuns who came to Notre Dame during the 60s was a lady by the name of Jean Gettelfinger, G-E-T-T-E-L. Like Father Cresci, she came to get her graduate degree in sociology. Unlike him, she never finished. Instead of getting a degree, she got a husband, and that husband was Father John Cresci. Jean Gettelfinger was one of the many nuns who left their narrow convent rooms in the 60s with the university, specifically the Catholic University, which was supposed to be contributing to their formation as the enabling device for leaving. One observer of the Notre Dame scene during the 60s said that this phenomenon was not uncommon, nor, we might add, was it particularly hard to understand. The general sense among religious that things were changing received powerful reinforcement at Notre Dame, primarily because the Notre Dame faculty and administration were one of the prime engines of that change. Add to that the fact that we are not talking about the abstract forces of history, but rather something as intimate as libido and its mobilization as part of the Cultural Revolution, and we can get some sense of the ferment at Notre Dame during the late 60s. Nuns and priests could be seen strolling hand in hand around the lakes. There was much talk of a third way, quote-unquote, somewhere between marriage and celibacy, partaking of the best aspects of both, no doubt. The impossible dream of a married clergy, of contraceptive sex, and most of the other ideas that make up the call to action agenda got hatched like a new bacillus in the hothouse atmosphere of the Notre Dame Summer School and similar academic institutes across the country. And since the growth of this impossible idea was congenial to the Cultural Revolutionaries' goals, it was fostered by their institutions. So at some point, Father Cresci and Sister Gettelfinger left the religious life and got married. Theirs was not an isolated incident. Unlike the Crescis, many priests and nuns became intimate and did not leave to get married. This group, combined with those that did leave, gradually coalesced into a group that began to lobby in an increasingly insistent way for change in the church's discipline regarding both sexuality and the religious life, and more often than not, both taken together. It's not hard to see the attractions both had separately. As religious in the most affluent country the world had ever known, priests and nuns got to live the vow of poverty in what was, at best, a deeply attenuated, symbolic form. Some indication of the rigor of religious life at Notre Dame can be seen in the fact that many married couples with families came there for vacations during the summer to swim in the lakes and play golf. A rigorous life teaching school for 9 months, followed by the Sybaris of the Notre Dame Summer School, must have been quite a change. I don't know what that Sybaris means. Presumably related to Sybaritic, but I don't know if it's an actual thing or a character. That change, coupled with the fact that everything else was changing, must have made this group of religious think that anything was possible. And if the inevitable was going to happen anyway, why not act on it in advance? Then, when the church didn't change, disappointment turned to anger, and anger to a determination to force the change that should have happened but never did. It must have seemed so tantalizingly close back then, the best of both worlds, the life of a religious, free of material cares, plus the sexual fulfillment of the married state. It was, as the Germans say, a chance to slaughter the cow and milk it too. By the time John Cresci received his PhD, which was also the time when the first consultations for the 1976 Call to Action conference began, this philosophy of the quote-unquote third way, which is another way of saying dissent, which is another way of describing the beachhead the Cultural Revolution had made in the Catholic Church, had made deep inroads among the nation's religious, and the vector of transmission was largely the church's educational system, specifically its system of higher and ongoing education, the summer programs at Notre Dame transposed across the country. From a demographic point of view, Call to Action had a very specific profile. It was essentially an organization of clerics, ex-clerics, and people who make a living working for the church, men and women who had adopted the sexual values, and oftentimes mores, of the dominant culture while working for the church. Notre Dame had a crucial role to play in the formation of this group during the decade from the mid-60s to the time of the actual Call to Action conference in October of 1976. In January 1977, 3 months after the Call to Action conference in Detroit and Leo Pfeffer's declaration of victory in the culture wars in Philadelphia, the Rockefeller Foundation announced that it has appointed as its new chairman the Reverend Theodore M. Hesburgh. So he goes from Notre Dame to Rockefeller Foundation. Hesburgh's decision to accept the chairmanship of the Rockefeller Foundation on January 14, 1977, unleashed a storm of indignation on the part of pro-life activists across the country in general, and Catholic pro-lifers in particular. Stung by the criticism, Hesburgh responded in the Notre Dame student newspaper by claiming that his critics were misinformed about the Rockefeller stand on abortion. Quote, "The foundation has nothing to do with abortion," opined Hesburgh. "In fact, you'll never find the word abortion in the report." Father Hesburgh concluded that his critics should know the facts before they made inflammatory statements. In an article published in the same student newspaper on April 20, 1977, Professor Charles E. Rice of the Notre Dame Law School proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that the word abortion did in fact rear its ugly head in the reports of the Rockefeller Foundation. The Foundation report for 1975 lists a grant to the American Civil Liberties Union Foundation for $5,000, quote, "for distribution to American obstetricians, gynecologists, of the educational brochure, The Abortion Controversy, A Doctor's Guide to the Law." Planned Parenthood Federation of America received $900,000 from the Rockefeller Foundation in the second quarter of 1974 for its, quote, "Centers for Family Planning Program Development." Rice goes on to cite one instance of Rockefeller-funded support for abortion after another, block quote. The February 1977 issue of the Rockefeller-subsidized publication, Abortion Research Notes, announced the formation in September 1976 of the National Abortion Council as a successor organization to the Association for the Study of Abortion, another group supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. The National Abortion Council was formed, quote, "with the primary aim of fostering the accessibility of quality abortion services," unquote. The Rockefeller-supported Abortion Research Notes announced that it had participated in the organizational meeting of NAC and was, quote, "pleased to present the NAC Statement of Principles," unquote, the tenor of which is exemplified by the statements, quote, "it is essential that abortion be readily available at reasonable fees," and "parental and spousal consent should not be required." So you have the former head of Notre Dame overtly lying that Rockefeller's not having anything to do, their foundation, with abortion, when in fact they are. Trying to make it easily accessible and cheap, and yeah, you don't need to tell anybody, your parents or your spouse, just do it. Rice also cites Rockefeller Foundation support for the Population Law Center, formerly the James Madison Constitutional Law Institute, which, quote, "has played," according to Rice, "a crucial role in changing American law to permit abortion." Population Law Center, that is. In the last half of 1974, the Rockefeller Foundation made a grant of $50,000 to the Institute for its, quote, "program in population law." Rice cites a similar grant made in 1972 and sees it as particularly significant because, quote, during the 1972, the James Madison Constitutional Law Institute handled the entire appeal for the abortion side in Roe versus Wade. And in the companion case of Doe v. Bolton, it filed the principal pro-abortion brief and wrote the legal arguments related to the medical aspect of the case. So they're involved in the case, and he's saying they're not involved at all. All of this led Rice to conclude that, in a realistic sense, the center is the legal spearhead of the abortion movement, so far from being uninvolved. Father Hesburgh was a member of the board of directors of the Rockefeller Foundation during this entire period. It is, therefore, difficult to understand just exactly what he means when he says that, quote, the foundation has nothing to do with abortion. Well, he's lying, breaking a Christian commandment. When Hesburgh was asked for a clarification after the appearance of the Rice article by the National Catholic News Service, he declined further comment.
Can I tell you? Sometimes I talk out of one side of my mouth, sometimes the other.
On July 10, 1978, John D. Rockefeller died in an automobile accident. He was 72 years old at the time. 6 months later, on January 26, 1979, John's brother Nelson died under mysterious circumstances involving a secretary. 20 years after the original call to action celebration, on March 6, 1996, Bishop Fabian Briskowitz of Lincoln, Nebraska, received a letter on Call to Action Nebraska stationery announcing the formation of Call to Action Nebraska, quote, an affiliate of the National Call to Action organization. It was this letter that was the proximate cause of Bishop Briskowitz's by now famous action. One co-signer of the letter was a John Cresci, a professor of sociology at Wesleyan University in Lincoln. It was this letter and the pending 20th anniversary celebration of the first Call to Action conference in Detroit which led Briskowitz to excommunicate Call to Action and a number of other groups in the Lincoln Diocese. On April 11, 1996, Call to Action representative James McShane met with the bishop to argue his case. By his own admission, he didn't get very far. When McShane complained about the severity of the punishment, Bishop Briskowitz brushed his concerns aside by claiming that its, quote, force could easily be lifted with obedience and repentance. So they say, look, we stand for something, you know, and you're gonna say that you stand for the exact opposite using our name? No, you don't. You're gone, buddy. Get out of here. There will be no revolution within the form. Maybe others will tolerate that. I won't tolerate it. Bye-bye. You know, and that's how it has to be done. And that's the right way to do it. And then you hear these fools talking about ideological purity and purity spiraling. Well, you got to protect the principles that are protecting you, or you have to defend them, or you have to choose the right ones and stick by them as they defend you. Otherwise, you got nothing. Anyway, that concludes the chapter. That was chapter 18 of part 3. We're up to page 555 out of like 607 of text, not counting notes. And so, thank you for being with me today. And I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll do part 3, chapter 19, which goes back to Indiana.